So this was joint work with Austin Clements, Irene Zhang, Sam Madden, and Barbara Liskov at MIT, making this a rare academic talk in this otherwise industry-dominated inside the data center session, which explains why this talk will not contain the word petabyte. So this is a talk about application-level caching, which is motivated, like a lot of work, by the scaling challenges faced by modern websites. And we've been hearing about scaling websites for a long time. But today we have some new challenges because our sites are faced with increasingly complex, dynamic, and personalized content. Think about Facebook, MediaWiki, which is running Wikipedia, or LiveJournal. And in these systems, existing caching techniques aren't as useful as they have been in the past. For example, web caches that cache entire web pages aren't so useful with all this personalized content. It doesn't do much good for a cache to serve my Facebook homepage up to you. And database caches don't solve the problem entirely, although they continue to be very useful, because we have more and more processing being done in the application layer. We've got code running in PHP and Java that's not just running database queries and printing out the results, but it's increasingly calling the shots about the management of the data and what processing to perform. So people have been turning to application-level caching techniques, such as Memcached or Java object caches. What we have here is a model where we start out with an application that's interacting with a database, and we're going to add in a cache on the side. And people who have been to previous OSDIs will recognize from the picture what we're talking about by this cache. It's essentially a distributed hash table, but in this case, it's one that's very lightweight, and it's stored entirely in memory. What's really notable about this cache is that it's storing application-level objects. It's letting the application choose what data to cache. It's not a database replica. It's not a query cache. It's not part of the database or integrated with it. And what this lets us do is cache higher-level data that's closer to application needs. We could use this cache just to cache database queries. We can also do more. A lot of applications follow a pattern where they're going to run some queries in the database to extract some data, then do some processing on it, say putting it into some kind of object form, and we can cache that directly. Or we can go further and take some of the partially generated web page, an HTML fragment, and store that in the cache. And unlike whole page caches, this lets us separate common and customized content. For example, a MediaWiki site has a sidebar that's in common for all the pages on the site, but the content on the page is different, and we can cache these separately. These caches let us reduce load on both the database and the application servers. Application server load doesn't get as much attention because it's relatively easier to remove an application server load bottleneck simply by adding more web servers to the system, but it matters even so because it becomes very expensive to do so because these servers aren't free. And so a savings in application server load can translate directly into a cost savings, which makes them appealing to a lot of large systems. But a problem with existing caches like Memcached is that they're very simple and they leave a lot of the work of managing them to the application. So for one thing, these caches don't provide transactional consistency, which is kind of unfortunate because the database community has years and years of work on figuring out how to make their systems provide serializable isolation for transactions, but then we're introducing these caches that aren't connected to the database and don't have any notion of transactions, which essentially destroys these guarantees. And as a result, we can run into situations where anomalies are exposed to the user, which might be unfortunate, but even in applications where that doesn't matter, application code sometimes has to be more complex because it has to deal with transient anomalies that violate invariants. So for example, in MediaWiki, it's often useful to cache some metadata about an article like its title separately from the article's contents itself. But if the cache can't guarantee that you're going to see a consistent result, the application needs to be very careful about which data it pulls from the cache. And these caches also typically provide a simple interface, like a hash table, which leaves the application responsible for deciding what data it's going to store in the cache and managing the cache. In particular, it has to worry about how to name the cache entries and which ones to access, and it also has to worry about how to keep the cache up to date as data changes. This might not seem like too much of a problem, but it's harder than you might think. We looked at some of the bugs that occurred from MediaWiki's use of Memcached and saw that there were some real problems here. For example, if the application is responsible for naming cache entries, then we need to make sure that we only store one thing under one key. The cache key has to uniquely identify the value. That sounds pretty straightforward, and it seems like it might be hard to get it wrong, but in fact, when the application is large and changing, it happens. So MediaWiki has a page that lists the recent changes to the system, and it was caching this, but it was caching this under the same key regardless of the number of days the user requested, so changing this had no effect. And invalidations can be even more troublesome, because figuring out what to invalidate when something changes in the database requires global reasoning about all the things that might be cached. So think about updating a page on Wikipedia. What do you have to invalidate? You can probably think of a few examples. You want to invalidate any cached copies of that page. You probably want to invalidate the recent changes list. And maybe, you know, there's some metadata associated with it on other pages that link to it. But something you might have missed was the object representing the user who made the edit, which contains the number of edits that user has made to the wiki, which serves some purposes in addition to boosting that user's ego. The MediaWiki developers missed this one at first and had to correct that later. This might sound like I'm picking on MediaWiki. I don't mean to say that their developers didn't know what they were doing. The problem here is that these things, naming and invalidations, require an understanding of the entire system. And in a very large system, which MediaWiki certainly is, it's got lots of features which interact in lots of ways and lots of developers working on it, no one person can understand the entire system, and even if they could, it would change the next day. So we're addressing these problems with a new cache, which we call TX cache, which provides three interesting features. First, it provides transactional consistency, meaning that the application is able to group operations into transactions, and then within a transaction, the application will see a serializable point-in-time view of the data in the system, regardless of whether it's getting its data from the cache or from the database. And TX cache also supports a flexible notion of staleness, which allows applications that can accept old, but slightly stale, but still consistent snapshots of the data to improve their hit rate by keeping objects around longer. And finally, we have a simpler interface based on function memoization, where rather than having the application manage the cache, applications simply mark functions in their code as being cacheable, and our cache automatically caches the results, handling the details of naming and invalidations. So the picture here is similar to the one we had with Memcached, we've introduced this new TX cache library, which is going to hide all the complexity of managing the cache so that the application doesn't need to be aware that the cache is there. It integrates with a new cache server we've developed and some minor modifications we made to a multi-version database, which we did with just a couple thousand lines of changes to Postgres. And together, these are going to ensure that the data seen by the application reflects a transactionally consistent view of the whole system. The interface that TX cache provides is simple. Applications will group their code into transactions, which will include application computation as well as database queries. So we have a pretty standard begin, commit, abort interface. The one thing we have to be careful here to do is that have applications specify whether their transactions are going to be read-only or read-write. This is because we're going to send read-write transactions directly to the database, bypassing the cache, which lets us avoid anomalies. But for read-only transactions, we can use the cache, and we allow the application to specify its staleness bound, which is how old the data that it's willing to use can be. Finally, the other part of our interface is a procedure for taking a function and making it cacheable. The function needs to be side effect free, so it can't change anything, and it needs to depend only on on the arguments provided and the state of the database in order to be suitable for caching. But once we make it cacheable, then the function will automatically return and reuse a cached result of a previous call with the same inputs, as long as it was still consistent with the view of the database and our transactional consistency criterion. That's our interface. That's our entire interface. And you'll notice that the application doesn't have to deal with invalidations. It doesn't have to deal with naming cache entries. It doesn't even really need to be aware that there is a cache. All it sees is that certain functions are going to run faster because they don't have to actually execute. The way this works is that when the application calls a cacheable function, that call is going to go is going to be intercepted by our cache library, which is going to take the arguments and the function name and combine them together to find a cache key and send a cache lookup to the right cache node. And if the data is in the cache, then it's returned directly to the application. But if the data isn't in the cache, then we have a cache miss, and the library is going to make an upcall to the application to execute the implementation of that function, which is going to run just like a normal function, probably making some queries on the database. And when it finishes, it's going to return to the library, which is going to insert the result into the cache so that it can be used by future calls. But all this stuff is happening behind the scenes, and the application doesn't have to be aware of it. All the application really sees is that it made a call to the function and possibly had an upcall back to the implementation of that function. Behind the scenes, the cache has to deal with a few different things. Two of the things I'm going to talk about that we have to do to make this happen are how we ensure transactional consistency and how we keep the cache up to date as data changes. So I'll start with consistency. Our goal here is that all data seen by a transaction from the cache or the database is as though it was running on a single snapshot of the database. And the way we're going to ensure this is to have the library assign a transaction, a timestamp to each transaction. And then we're going to have every object that's stored in the cache or database tagged with its validity interval, which is the range of timestamps at which that result was valid. And then our consistency goal can be restated as saying that a transaction is only allowed to read data if the data's validity interval contains that transaction's timestamp. So looking at the cache then, we can, rather than having just a simple hash table interface, all of the keys in the cache contain one or more immutable versions of that object tagged with their validity intervals. And this lets us do a lookup for a value at a certain time. So if we know the timestamp of a transaction, as indicated by the red line here, then we know which values we're allowed to access in the cache, the ones that intersect, the bottom two. And we're assuming for now that we know the actual validity interval, even though the upper bound when an object becomes invalid might be sometime in the future. We'll sort this out later when we come back to invalidations. But something else you can see here is that it can be beneficial to allow applications to access slightly stale data. So if we're running on the latest transaction, then we're only able to take those bottom two cached objects because the other ones have become invalid earlier. But if the application is willing to accept data that's, say, up to 30 seconds old, then that gives us a range of possible timestamps that it can accept, and we can choose the one that lets us use the most cache data. And you can see here that by running at this other timestamp, we're able to use all four of the keys we're showing, allowing the cache data to be used longer. One complication, though, is that if we're going to allow a transaction to access slightly stale cache data in the cache, we need to make sure that if we have to integrate it with some data from the database, if there's a cache miss, that we get consistent data. And that requires us to be able to start a database transaction at the same timestamp that the library has chosen for use in the cache. This might seem like an unusual requirement, but it's exactly what snapshot isolation databases need to support internally. So we were able to simply add an interface to expose this to the cache library, allowing the cache library to control the timestamp that a transaction used on the database. But where do these validity intervals come from? The cache is filled with application-level objects. So the validity of an application-level object is the validity of the database queries that were used to generate it. And in order to do this, we figure this out. We have our library track the query dependencies that a cacheable function uses to generate its result. The validity of a database query comes from the validity of the tuples that were accessed to compute it, and we've modified the database to report this. And finally, what it comes down to is the validity of an individual tuple, which is given by the timestamps of the transactions that created it and deleted it, which is something that multi-version databases already track. So if we think about the internal representation of data in a multi-version database, it can be viewed in a similar way to what we have in the cache. We've got four tuples here, X, Y, Z, and Q, and they're already tagged with their validity intervals. We know that tuple X was created by transaction number 41, and it might have been deleted by transaction 50. So when the database is going to do a transaction, that transaction is assigned a timestamp, same red line, and the tuples that it's going to see are the ones that red line intersects. So if we do a query for all of these tuples, we'll get we'll get X and Y returned. And what we can also see is that this we'd get the same query result if we ran it on a different set of timestamps as well, which are the validity intervals, which is the validity interval of this query result. So you can see that we would have gotten the same result if we ran it at any time after time 41, which was when tuple y was inserted, but we would have gotten a different result if we ran it at some time after transaction 48, which was when tuple q was inserted. So we've modified the database server to track this by intersecting the validity intervals of the tuples that it accesses and returning these with each select query. Two complications you might note are that we had to look at tuple q in order to determine the validity interval of the result, even though that tuple wasn't in the result set. And also, we have more complicated processing to do to figure this out for a more complicated query, like one that does a join or aggregate. And the details of that are in the paper. One other optimization we have in our cache is that up till now, we assumed that the library chooses the timestamp for a transaction in advance. But this is actually something that's pretty hard for it to do, because at the time a transaction starts, we don't know what data it's going to access in the cache, and we don't even know what data is in the cache or what validity intervals it has, because that data is spread out over multiple cache nodes, which are on different hosts. But our insight is that we can make a better choice because we don't have to choose the timestamp right away. Initially, the application is willing to accept any data that satisfies its staleness limit, which gives us a range of timestamps from, say, within the last 30 seconds. And for our first cache lookup, we can accept any one of those anything that intersects any one of those timestamps. But once we've read something, then we have to make sure that we only read other things that are consistent with what we've already seen, which restricts what we're able to access. And as we read more data, the interval that we're able to use shrinks. But this lets us choose the timestamp to run a transaction at without having knowledge up front about what cache data it's going to access. So let's move on to invalidations. Up till now, I made this assumption that we always knew the upper and lower bounds of the validity of an object, but most objects in the system are still valid. Their validity interval extends to sometime in the future, and how do we deal with that? We're going to represent those as open-ended validity intervals because we don't know the upper bound yet. And later, we're going to have the database send a notification to the cache if one of these objects might have changed, and the cache is going to update the interval to reflect that. But how does the database know which objects have changed? The database doesn't know which application-level objects are cached. It's not even aware of the existence of application-level objects. To deal with this, we built a data dependency tracking system based on which we call invalidation tags, where we modify the database to return with each query a set of tags reflecting what data it accessed. And then, whenever the database is updated, it will generate the list of tags that could have been affected by that update, which the cache will use to find the associated objects and update their intervals accordingly. The invalidation tags themselves come from the access methods that the query uses to look up data. Most queries in web applications are going to do index lookups, and for these, the invalidation tag we get, as shown in the example, is going to be consist of the name of the table and the key value pair that we use to perform the lookup. We also support wildcard tags for non-indexed queries that need to look at the entire table, but these are relatively rare in web applications because they need to look at the entire table, and that's typically an undesirable thing to do. Then, when data is updated in the database is going to generate the list of affected tags, which is one tag for each index key of each tuple that's been inserted, modified, or deleted. And it's going to broadcast this list to all of the cache nodes as an ordered stream with the transaction timestamps. And the cache is going to use this stream to update the intervals of the objects it's storing. Cache lookups treat anything that's currently unbounded as being bounded by the timestamp of the last invalidation received, which lets us avoid some race conditions which actually exist when invalidation messages arrive out of order with lookups and inserts. Let's move on to the evaluation. We wanted to answer three questions. How much do applications benefit from adding a cache? And how much does this benefit depend on the amount of stale data that the application is willing to tolerate? And finally, what's the cost of providing transactional consistency in this cache? We evaluate all three of these using the Rubus benchmark, which is a simulated eBay-like auction site. We used its standard browsing and bidding workload, which is 85% read-only transactions, and we ran it with two data sets. One of them was very small, 850 megs, designed to fit in memory on our database server in its buffer cache, and the other was larger, 6 gigs, which meant that its performance was bound by disk accesses. And this represents two different ways in which databases for web applications are often run. We ran this on a small cluster of machines, where one server was dedicated as a database server running our modified version of Postgres, and the rest were either cache servers or front ends running Apache and PHP. For the in-memory database, we used two cache nodes, and this graph shows how performance is affected by changing the size of the cache on the x-axis. The top graph shows the throughput achieved by the system in requests per second, with the red line being the baseline without caching, and the bottom graph shows the corresponding cache hit rate. And what we see, not too surprisingly, is that as we increase the cache size, we get a larger hit rate, which corresponds directly to an improvement in throughput because each cache hit represents load that's being taken off the database. And of course, there's a limited benefit to increasing the cache size beyond that of the working set of the database. On the disk-bound database, we've got some similar yet slightly different results. Again, the cache hit rate and throughput is increasing as we increase the size of the cache, although we weren't able to get the cache size large enough to include the entire database. You'll notice that the cache hit rate is always very high. It's usually well into the 90s, even for small caches, but that doesn't always translate directly into a throughput improvement. The reason for that is that there are some objects that are accessed very frequently, and we almost always hit in the cache on these, but they're also frequently stored in the database's buffer cache, so we don't get a huge amount of benefit from caching these. The actual bottleneck on this workload, which doesn't have a lot of locality, is a random I.O. for a set of items that are each accessed very infrequently, and thus our performance comes down to pretty much how many of these we're able to fit in the cache. This next experiment shows the improvement in throughput that we get as we vary the staleness limit. That's on the x-axis, and the y-axis is the relative throughput to the system without caching, the red line. And the blue and green lines, respectively, are the in-memory and disk-bound workloads. What we can see here is that having even a little bit of staleness is very important for performance. The reason for this is that we've got a lot of objects that change frequently, and if we're not able to tolerate stale data, that means that they're not useful in the cache. On the other hand, if we're able to keep them around a little longer because the application is willing to accept data that's already been invalidated, then we're able to reuse these objects, and that's very useful. But the impact of increasing the staleness beyond, say, 30 or 60 seconds is pretty limited because most of these objects are accessed repeatedly in that time frame. And finally, we wanted to know whether providing transactional consistency is a barrier to performance. So to do this, we looked at some of the statistics from these runs, and we classified cache misses into a few different types based on the standard classification for processor cache misses. The first three are compulsory staleness and capacity misses, which are the sort of thing that would be common to other caches. The one that's interesting to us are consistency misses, where we have data that's available in the cache, it's sufficiently fresh, but we can't use it because it's inconsistent with data that the application has already seen. And we examined the percentage of total misses that were consistency misses for four of our different workloads, and what we see is that in all cases, it's under 10%, and in some cases, it's well under 1%. We verified this experimentally by rerunning one of the previous experiments. So this graph is the one we saw a few minutes ago where we have the peak throughput as a function of the cache size. The red line is our no caching baseline, and the blue line is the result we saw before. But what we have now, in addition, is this green line, which reflects our system with consistency disabled, where a transaction is allowed to read any data that's valid in the last 30 seconds, regardless of whether it's consistent with other data that it's seen. And what we can see here is that the improvement for this is pretty small, corresponding to that under 10% increase in cache misses. So there's some related work on application-level caches, web caches, and database replication. I won't go into detail on it, but it's discussed in the paper. What we've presented here is a new application-level cache, TX cache, that is a simpler programming model. It provides transactional consistency across both the cache and the database, ensuring that the application is always seeing results consistent with executing on a single snapshot of the database, even if it's accessing data in the cache. And TXCache provides automatic management of the cache, making applications no longer responsible for having to deal with looking up, updating, and invalidating data in the cache, which we've seen can be a source of complexity and bugs in applications. To make this happen, we had to introduce some new mechanisms, an approach to ensuring consistency based on explicitly tracking the validity intervals of objects, and a system for tracking data dependencies and automatically generating invalidations. We've seen that adding this cache can improve the performance of web applications, and there's little performance penalty from providing consistency. I'd be happy to take questions.
Atuladia, Google. So you mentioned that you have to figure out the tuples that are needed that were needed to compute the validity of the query in the database. So do you run into those similar kind of problems you run with sort of predicate locks and things like that, trying to sort of track? For example, if I'm doing a table scan or if I'm doing some kind of a complicated predicate with joins.
So we're actually tracking specifically the index query, the access methods that are used in order to determine our invalidation tags, which is sort of similar to predicate locking. And in fact, we have a more complex approach based on predicate locks. So it's quite similar, but this is a simpler approach.
Okay. Another thing, how do you deal with failures in your cache? Like if your nodes go down or they're unavailable for short periods of time? Or
sure. I haven't discussed fault tolerance here. And one of the reasons is that this being a cache, it's sort of inherently fault tolerant in that if a node goes down, we can just treat the lookups for it as cache misses. Of course, you know, you can add additional complexity to that if you don't want to pay that performance price. For example, you know, migrating data away from failed nodes and so on.
You don't face problems with the validity intervals?
No, because they're ultimately generated by the database, and we're not concerned with failures of the database.
All right, thanks.
Marcos Aguilera, MSR Silicon Valley. You kept using this word transactional consistency. I think what you mean by that was isolation. And it wasn't clear to me whether you're providing serializability or snapshot isolation. And you used both words in your talk.
Right, that's a good question. And what the reason I was a little vague about that is that it depends on what the underlying database supports. So if the underlying database supports snapshot isolation, then we'll provide that too. If it provides serializability, then we can provide that also. That's because we're using the cache only for read-only transactions. So as long as the cache is seeing a consistent snapshot, then it is in the serial ordering.
Etienne Lesser, UNSW. Nick, you had a graph there of the throughput of the Rubus workload against cache size for the 6 gig workload.
Right.
It seemed that your throughput was still going up even though the cache hit rate was leveling off. Can you explain why that is?
Sure. We're seeing that the effective size of the cache is greater than the size needed for the cache is greater than the actual data, and that's because we're caching application level objects, which introduces additional overhead. For example, because some of the objects include HTML pages, which are larger than the data used to generate them, and also because we're caching at multiple levels of granularity, so that the same data might appear in the cache more than once. And another issue is that the database server may be doing some compression. I don't recall whether that's accounted for.
Right. Okay.
So you showed the cache as a distributed cache built over multiple systems. I'm wondering, do you still get a performance win if you have a database and a single cache node on a single system, or do you only start to get a performance win if you distribute it over multiple systems?
So the benefit of having the cache in a distributed architecture is that it's very easy to increase the size of the cache. But you know, really the only impact of having more or having fewer nodes is the effective size of the cache, the amount of memory it has available.
So does the performance of the have you compared the performance of distributing the cache versus, say, distributing the database via replication, since it would be easy to run read-only queries against a hot standby, for example?
Sure. There are a lot of approaches based on database replication that do sort of similar things. And one Most of them are more heavyweight because they try to scale writes as well. And another important difference is that our cache is operating at an application level, which means that it can reduce load on the application servers as well, which is something that database replication systems can't do.
Okay. Adam Costello, Google. I think you said early on that your library chooses the cache key automatically.
Right.
But you didn't talk about how that's done.
Sure, it's chosen based on the function name and the function's name and its arguments. So the key that's used to cache the result of a function call is the name of the function and the arguments that were used. And you know, you could use some more complex approaches if you were worried about the code changing. For example, using a hash of the code instead.
Oh, okay. Well, so something I've seen. I don't know how common it is, but sometimes the arguments contain a lot of data that doesn't actually matter, and if you include it all in the cache key, then you'll have a hit rate of zero.
Yes, that's true. Although, you know, this shows that this sort of interface allows you to add caching easily to an application, there's still work to be done to make sure that caching performs effectively.
Okay.